Cool. One of the animals there. All right.
What was
that? Oh, that was a hoary marmot. It's the biggest of the marmots. They actually get to be 25 pounds. Second largest rodent on the planet. So, and you have to go to Canada to find them. So, and they're very friendly. Yeah. They eat like, and they're not wanting your food. But whenever they see a human being, they'll pose for a picture. So, quite an interesting little creature. Not at all afraid of humans. So, probably because the humans that go where they live aren't there to hunt. They're just there to climb. So, I spent 2.5 days in Reading last week. As you know, I was zipping off in an airplane right after class. Thank you for letting me get away. I did make my plane. And Kathy got to go with me this time. And we needed her because it was a very intense time. They had me address 1,500 students of what was called the School of Supernatural Ministry. And you can probably guess by the name, Bethel is a charismatic Pentecostal church, which really believes that God is imbuing Christians today with the same kind of gifts that they did during the Book of Acts here. And by the way, I believe that too. But I do take a different perspective, that God reserves the 1 Corinthians 12 list of gifts. And let me just make a distinction there. When it comes to spiritual gifts, supernatural gifts that God gives to his people, they come in three categories. There are the motivational gifts you see in Romans 12, and every Christian gets a motivational gift. But you get one. You don't get a bunch. You get one. But it's a gift whereby God will supernaturally empower you to perform ministry on his behalf. And so if you read the list, there's seven of them. There's the gift of prophecy, which is someone who's motivated to bring people to repentance. There's the teaching gift, the exhortation gift, which is applying what is being taught. Then you've got the gift of administration. We need lots of those, especially at Reasons to Believe. We don't have enough. So... then there's the giver, and you might think the giver is motivated to give. No, the giver is motivated to get people to give, and is also motivated to raise up resources for the work of ministry. And then you have the servant, and then the one who is gifted to use mercy as a tool to bring people to faith in Christ. In fact, all of them are designed to assist the church in fulfilling the Great Commission, taking the good news of Jesus Christ to all the people groups of the world. Then in Ephesians 4, you've got what are called the office gifts, and those are strictly reserved for those people that are the leaders and ministers of the different churches. And the principle there is that a church should not just have one minister, but a multiplicity of ministers, because once again, the ministers get one of the five office gifts. They don't get all five. And there's a real need for all five to be expressed within a fellowship. And I've often used that as an argument for why churches shouldn't be extremely tiny. You want the church to be large enough that you have a multiplicity of leaders and ministers in the church that they can exercise all five of the gifts that are listed there. And then 1 Corinthians 12 are what are called the supernatural acts. And there's nine of these supernatural gifts listed in 1 Corinthians 12. And how I interpret that list is that these are things that the Holy Spirit will do through a believer. This is not a gift you possess. It's a gift that comes and goes. And so sometimes the gifts are expressed with you, sometimes they're not. And that's probably my biggest critique of Pentecostal theology, the idea that each Christian gets a 1 Corinthians 12 gift and they get to keep it. No, my belief is that it comes and goes, just like it did in the book of Acts. And it comes when the Christian minister is facing supernatural barriers to the spreading of the gospel. It's basically God's way of showing that he is more powerful than the demons that the people may be frightened of or worshiping. And so God will step in and demonstrate through these powerful supernatural acts that he is there to break down the barriers. You've got nothing to fear from the evil one. But the theology I take on that is if you're not facing supernatural barriers, don't expect these gifts of healing, raising people from the dead, prophecy where people are being able to foretell the future. Don't expect these gifts to be manifested if there are no supernatural barriers to the spreading of the gospel. For the people under demonic oppression, you will see it, which explains why these gifts are much more frequently expressed on the mission field than they are, say, here in America. And, you know, I'm critical of churches that say this is happening every Sunday morning. If it's happening every Sunday morning in your church sanctuary, then you've got problems with your church sanctuary. It shouldn't be happening on Sunday morning in a church sanctuary, but you would expect it to be happening. And we got to see these gifts being expressed through our people here at Sierra Madre Congregational Church when we were doing door-to-door evangelism in a particular street in Pasadena that was nothing but witchcraft covens. And, you know, they were performing supernatural acts, but we got to see them upstage by what God was able to do. Now, I'll tell you this. Once the witchcraft covens left, we didn't see these acts being expressed anymore. There's really no need. If people respond to this book and through prayer, then this is the normative means by which God will speak. Just kind of like I told you the story last week about how my younger sister, who became a Christian, wouldn't read the Bible, wouldn't go to church, wouldn't pray, but God would communicate to her through dreams and visions. And as soon as she started studying the Bible, no more dreams and visions. And she got quite frightened, thinking, gee, has the Holy Spirit left me? She called me on the phone. I said, no, this is good news. This is very good news, because now God can communicate to you through a much more effective and powerful means than he was able to do in the past. So this is a good thing. But what I was sharing with the School of Supernatural Ministries, I purposely started my whole seminar series off by saying, I come to you here to give you a guarantee that you will see miracles in your life as a minister of God. And all you need to do is obey 1 Peter 3:15-16, which says, always be ready to give good reasons for the hope within you with gentleness and respect and a clear conscience. And the point there is, if you will prepare these sound reasons, then God will supernaturally bring people across your path. Because after all, the workers are few. And there are many people out there that are hungry to hear the truth. But of course, God is going to try to bring people that are hungry to hear the truth with those that are properly prepared. And I said, you know, my ministry experience over the past 40 years, those who are properly prepared will see many, many miracles take place in their life, akin to what you see in the book of Acts, where you've got the Ethiopian eunuch reading the book of Isaiah, really hungry to understand what the prophet was communicating in Isaiah 53. And what did God do? He supernaturally translated Philip, one of the first deacons of the church, put him right beside the chariot of the Ethiopian eunuch. And the Ethiopian eunuch was blessed by Philip being able to explain Isaiah 53 is all about the Messiah's prophesied to come. And I got good news for you. He's already come. Told him the story. And what did the Ethiopian eunuch do? He says, hey, here's some water. Why can't I be baptized right now? Why should I wait for a baptism? Let's do it right now. He got baptized. And you know what happened to Philip? The Holy Spirit whisked him away. Took him back to the land of Judea. So, and I, you know, before launching into my seminar, I just told the story I told you about what happened when I was on my way from San Francisco to Seattle on an airplane. And somehow, I've only flown first class twice in my life. And this time they said, look, the regular compartment is full. We notice you've got a lot of miles. Do you mind if we put you in first class? So I said, well, I think I can tolerate that. But I wound up sitting beside a fellow who also never flies first class. But he says, hey, I'm being flown to Seattle to consult with Microsoft, and they insisted on flying me first class. So don't get any wrong ideas about me. And then I found out that he was a German atheist physicist who was a quantum physicist. And, you know, what are the odds that a Christian astrophysicist would be sitting right next to a German atheist quantum physicist, both of whom never fly first class? And then, you know, just how he started off by saying, let me tell you the reason why I am an atheist. I says, you know, why would the universe be so big if God is responsible for this? Well, that's actually the first chapter of one of my latest books. And so kind of went through that a little bit. And he said, well, I got another one. Why would it be so old? And I said, well, that's chapter 2. And then the entire airplane ride, we actually went through the book. He was bringing up every chapter in the book. And so I happened to have a copy of the book. I gave it to him. And he also said, you know, do you have anything in German? And I said, well, I actually have something in my briefcase in German. And it's not very often that I was able to give him a Journey Toward Creation over there that's in 11 languages. So,
was that book,
Joe? No, the book was Why the Universe is the Way It Is. Right. But no, he was the one at the end of the flight that said, I know it's no accident that the two of us were sitting together on this airplane.
Wow.
This is exactly what I needed. And the other thing I noted, too, is his attitude was hostile at the beginning, and it completely turned the other way around. So that was a great launch. I mean, after that, the people really listening to everything I had to say. By the way, it's still up on the web. They live-streamed the thing, and it's still there available. I know a number of you were watching the five lectures there on the web, but it is still available. Yes.
So many of these chance encounters that you've had, hospital, airplane, whatever, do you ever get any follow-up? Do you ever hear from these people later?
Yes, I do. And particularly the ones that happen in this area, they'll often come by our office and want additional books, and then they get to meet everybody. So, yeah, that often happens. And incidentally, on my plane ride home, it happened again. Because what happened on the plane ride home is that, you know, we got Kathy's ticket late. We were able to sit together in the flight up, but in the flight back, we were separated. So, and we were separated by about 20 seats. But the guy who sat down beside me was an elderly fellow from China. He spoke English, but with an accent. And I found out that he is a Chinese esthetician. And want to know what that is? Well, his job is to kind of set up the aesthetics for hotel lobbies. And he literally flies all over the world working with architects to design hotel lobbies so that they would be places where people would feel comfortable, kind of serenity kind of thing. He says, no, he wasn't into feng shui, but he said, I just kind of have a sense of what it is that makes people feel secure and comfortable in a lobby. So he literally goes all around the world. He's actually published some books on it. But as we started talking, I found out he's a real fan of Feng Leiji, the famous Chinese astrophysicist. And so he was well aware of the statement in Feng Leiji's book about how physicists, because of recent discoveries, are now encroaching on a discipline that used to be the exclusive purview of theologians. So we got to talking. Anyway, he was, in fact, I got to show him one of my messages where I actually kick it off with a quote from Feng Leiji. So he was quite impressed with that. Anyway, it turns out he comes from a Buddhist background, but he says, you know, Buddhism has always had some problems with it, and he kind of mentioned some of the things that bothered him about Buddhism. I was able to share, well, you know, that's all taken care of in Christianity. And he said, well, I had some hints of that. But anyway, it was a great conversation. But again, what are the odds that a Chinese esthetician would be sitting beside?
You're and a so, skeptics magnet.
And anyway, we agreed to trade books. He's reading my book. I'm reading his book. So, and I could really use some help on aesthetics. That's one of my great weaknesses. I mean, you know, I don't care if there's any windows in the room at all, as long as I got the appropriate books and a three-prong plug for my computer, I'm good.
Do you pray specifically about your travels before you leave?
Well, I simply pray that I would recognize the opportunities when God puts them there. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I didn't have to start the conversation. This gentleman started it. Mm-hmm. So, and, you know, I was just thinking, you know, there's a reason why Kathy and I are separated on this trip. So, and so just kind of being sensitive to when it happens. There are other times where I think God wants me to work. So if nothing happens, I work. And if something happens, well, usually it does. So, but anyway, it was really a good time there. And the international school, I mean, we literally had over half the students there from outside the country. So it was fun talking to this group where they were from literally all over the world. So, okay.
Can you repeat those biblical references on the first two types of gifts?
Oh, sure. you go to Romans 12, where you get the list of the motivational gifts. Ephesians 4, the office gifts for the ministers of the church. And then it's 1 Corinthians 12. So there's three different categories of gifts. And by the way, it was about 30 years ago I taught in this class about a six-month series on spiritual gifts. And that got recorded. In fact, Bob Stewart at Reasons to Believe continues to teach the class that we taught in spiritual gifts. So that is available for anyone who would like to go through that class. Just contact Bob and he'll let you know the next time we're doing that series. Well, I think what Bob has done is he's taken all my notes, because I had very extensive notes. And so he's using my notes, and I don't know all the details of how he's... But I do know over the past 25 years, Bob has been repeatedly teaching this class on spiritual gifts.
Was it recorded here or at Reasons?
And it was recorded in the Park House. This is when we were across the street in the Park House. So... but exactly what Bob is using, because he was in that class. Oh, there we go, that little creature again. Okay, let me tell you about another creature. this was released just a few days ago in the February journal. Let me see what the journal is. Here we go. It's the Journal of Experimental Biology, and it's in the March 1st issue. So March 1st hasn't hit yet, but they did publish it in advance. And what's interesting about this study is the fact that it combines an interdisciplinary team. And one thing we've shared in this class here is that, you know, a lot of the design that's out there, evidence for God's supernatural design, is hidden from view because people over-specialize. And what I've been noticing in the scientific literature is that a lot of these new discoveries for supernatural design come about when you get people from multiple disciplines collaborating with one another. And this is a good example of that. This is a group of European researchers from Eastern Europe and Western Europe. And it involves physicists as well as biologists and then mathematicians. And what it has to do is trying to figure out why the zebra has stripes. And, you know, kids ask that question, right? Why do zebras have stripes? And I remember the answer that's always been in the textbooks is that they have stripes because that makes it difficult for the predators to catch them. And there's two theories I've heard in the past. One is that the stripes actually provide some camouflage because the zebras are in tall grass. It's kind of a striped look, kind of like with the tigers, too. They have stripes, and the idea is it provides some camouflage. The other thing I heard is that with the stripes where you get a whole bunch of zebras together, it creates problems for the astigmatism of the predators. So I'm not sure these predators have the astigmatism problems because, you know, we humans do, but notice it takes a long time for our eyes to have those problems with dancing patterns. For predators that only live, say, 10, 15 years, I'm not sure that's a good answer. But finally, I think they've come up with the right answer. And it has to do with the polarization of light. And it has to do not with the predators, but a different kind of predator, which are horseflies. And so, yeah, horseflies. Because what they notice in the wild is just how bothered large, warm-blooded mammals are by these horseflies. And hey, I personally experienced that when I was at the Algonquin Radio Observatory, where, you know, Americans would come up and say, gee, you know, how do you Canadians handle this climate? It just seems like it's winter all the time. We say, oh, no, no, no. We actually get four real seasons. We get 2 weeks of black flies, 2 weeks of mosquitoes, 2 weeks of horse flies, and 10.5 months of winter. You know, we are a four-season place. But yeah, it would literally snow every month except July. But I do remember going up there once during horsefly season. And it was one of my more terrifying experiences because you would go outside and immediately the horseflies would come upon you. And what they're trying to do is drill into your scalp and take a piece of flesh out and then lay eggs there. So it's like, you know, and it's just so painful. And... anyway, we were driven to the telescope, and but then we had to walk back to the dormitory, and it was a mile walk. And so here we naively went outside and got inundated by these horseflies and said, we have to sprint. Now, sprinting 1 mile is not easy to do. And so we were running full bore, but we're right beside this lake. And I'll tell you, the horseflies were so incredibly annoying and painful, we jumped into the lake just to get away from them. Wow. But then as we looked up, we could see that they were waiting for us to surface. Well, I figured at least get the sweat off, because the sweat's attracting them. So, but yeah, I mean, they were just buzzing there. And anyway, we finally made it back to the place. And after that, we said, we're not walking anymore. We're getting a ride every time we're going there and back. It was just so miserable. Well, they also noticed that this is a real misery for large-bodied mammals. They call them horseflies for a reason, because they love to attack horses. And it's not just that they annoy these creatures and bite them. They spread disease. And they can spread some significantly terrible diseases. So they're figuring that, maybe these zebra stripes have something to do with that. And what they notice is flies like horizontal polarization. Why? Because they are born in water. They need water. I mean, if you actually look at these nature films or nature videos on TV, whether looking at the lions or other animals, you always notice they're surrounded by flies. The flies are wanting water. And in fact, I notice when we've been to Africa that flies will go after your eyes, and they go after the corners of your mouth. They're trying to get the water. And I would see these families with their kids out there, and the flies would be all over the children's eyes. And I said, well, why aren't they, just batting them away? They said, you get tired. The flies are so persistent and so intense that they basically exhaust you, then you just let them come after you. So they're just after the water. And so, but I mean, it's kind of sad just seeing all these people wandering around with flies all over their eyes. And they explain some of the eye diseases that they get there. But of course, that happens to the animals as well. A quick question, then I'll move on.
That seems to be one of the animals that God didn't give us dominion over.
Well, you can say that. We don't have dominion over the mosquitoes either.
I was in Australia in the outback. We went up there to look for gold. And we spent 10 days up there. And talk about flies. They say, we have to wear face masks, nets, and a hat, and cover our hand and everything. And they would go for moisture, and your back when you
perspire, start sweating. Yeah,
totally black with these flies.
Right. Well, the black flies are like that. When we'd have 2 weeks of black flies, same thing would happen. If there was a sweat spot in your shirt, they were all over it, just dense like that. And yeah, I had some friends from Australia, and they said, yeah, this is what they call the North Territory salute. They're always constantly batting the flies away. So, yeah.
There are pills that you can give animals for fleas. You can give them the pill, and the fleas don't come. I wonder if there's any kind of pill that you can take, if they've ever researched that, that would keep
Well, at the observatory, I asked them, what do you do about horseflies? And they basically said, there's nothing you can do about horseflies. They're big, they're persistent, and you just have to wait for them to die. They only last 2 weeks. So when the 2 weeks are gone, no more horseflies. And so after that, I didn't get telescope time during horsefly season. So let the Americans get the time during the horsefly season. It didn't take me long to figure out, too, the best time to get telescope time was January and February, when it was 45 and 50 below, because that pulled all the water out of the atmosphere. And that's the thing. Once it gets dry, the flies disappear. So anyway, back to the story here. What they did is these researchers went to a notorious farm outside of Budapest, Hungary. And this is a horse farm where the horses are just covered with horse flies all the time. And so the physicists went out there, and what they did is they kind of took various striped patterns and geometric. They tried triangles and circles and stripes of various widths and various colors. And what they found out is that black and white stripes that are narrow are the least attractive to horseflies. And they also took some zebra hides and discovered that the zebra hides do just as well as the narrow black and white stripes. And then what the physicists were able to calculate is that what happens is that the black favors one polarization of light, the white favors the opposite polarization of light, and you keep them close enough together, and if you make them vertical, that tells the horseflies this is not a place where you're getting horizontal polarized light, and therefore this is a place where we're not likely to get water or any kind of a fluid. They're after the fluid of the zebra, and so it discourages them from landing on the zebra. And where it's particularly bright sunlight, which is the case for the tropics, the polarization effect will be most effective. And that's something that wasn't in the research paper that I think would have been worth adding, is the fact, where do you find these narrow striped animals where you've got a sharp distinction between a dark stripe and a bright stripe? It's in the tropics. You know, the tigers, the zebras. What do you call these animals that are related to giraffes? No. That's it.
Okapi.
Yeah, the okapis also have these vertical stripes where you got a white stripe right next to a dark stripe that's quite narrow. And it's always the large, warm-blooded animals that have these vertical stripe patterns. And so they concluded this has got nothing to do with camouflage. It's got everything to do with warding off these nasty flies. And it's not something that just bothers the prey. It also bothers the predators. So it explains why, for example, tigers would have this. Lions don't, but tigers are bigger than lions. And tigers tend to live in wetter climates where the flies would be more prevalent. Anyway, kind of an interesting study on why these creatures have the stripes that they do. And you might say, well, how come the other creatures in the African plains don't? Notice that it's the large prey that have the stripes. So, you know, you actually see some striping on some other large ones too. The small ones, like the, what's the one that's really abundant in Africa? The wildebeest. They don't have stripes, but they're a much smaller mammal than the zebras. And so it's the zebras that are exposed, where the flies can see them, that are most bothered by this. Hey, let me give you another one that I think is quite interesting too, completely different field of science. And these are two papers that were both published in the January 10th issue of the Astrophysical Journal, one in the letters and one in the actual journal. And it has to do with trying to explain why our solar system is so orderly, but all these exoplanetary systems we're looking at are so chaotic. What's causing all the chaos? And it's something we've only noticed with the completion of the exoplanet catalogs. Not that they're complete, but right now we have 758 planets that not only have been discovered, but where we know the masses of the planets and we know their orbital features. And what's been amazing is how many of them are super-Earths. A super-Earth is a planet between 1 and 10 times the mass of the Earth, and how many of them are the size of Neptune and Uranus that are orbiting close to the star. This is something we don't see in our solar system. All the inner solar system planets are tiny. Earth is the biggest, the rest are smaller. But this is not what we're seeing in these exoplanetary systems. We're seeing lots of large planets orbiting close to their star. But one of the big mysteries is if you look at those that are orbiting as close to the star as one quarter the distance of the Earth from the star. Now, what that would tell us, if you've got a large planet that's orbiting within one quarter of the Earth-Sun distance of its star, then it should have a perfectly circular orbit. Why? Because the tidal interaction between the star and the planet is going to be so enormous as to force over a relatively brief period of time a perfectly circular orbit. But then you look at the statistics. Okay, there are 264 planets out of that 758 that are orbiting within one quarter of the Earth-Sun distance of their planet. And of these 264, 124 have an eccentricity, and maybe I need to define that term. A circular orbit is, you know what that is, but of course no planet has a perfectly circular orbit. Newton's laws tell us that planets orbit about their stars in an ellipse. Eccentricity is a measure of how elliptical the orbit is. So a high ellipticity means that it's got this kind of an orbit, whereas a low ellipticity means that it's close to circular. And we would call it a near circular orbit if the eccentricity is less than 0.05, 1 being a parabolic orbit, 0 being a circle. And 124 of these 264 planets are less than 0.05, and I can tell you a lot of the remaining 140 are barely under the 0.05. The mathematics tells us they should be virtually an exact zero. So the question is, how do we explain all these high eccentricity, close orbiting planets? And the answer is, this study here is called Pumping the Eccentricity of Exoplanets. And what they discovered is if you've got another large planet in the system, and in many cases they have yet to discover these large distant planets because they're more difficult to detect, but they said they've got to be there because it's the only way we can explain these high eccentricities. But what they did was they did a number of computer simulations that showed that if you've got a distant planet, then its gravity working on the smaller planet that's orbiting close to its star will actually pump up the eccentricity and make it more and more eccentric as time goes by, and will finally kick the thing out of the solar system or kick it into the star, out of the planetary system or kick it into the star. It will go unstable. And of course, that's not a good prescription for advanced life. If you've got that going on in your planetary system, then there's no possibility for life surviving on your planet. Why? Because the planet that has advanced life on it would have to be smaller than both planets. And if that kind of chaos is going on, it's going to disturb the orbit of the planet with advanced life on it and make advanced life impossible on that planet. But the real question is, how did the solar system escape this? Because after all, we got lots of gas giant planets that are distant from the small planets. Well, one of the things is that the smaller the planet, the less the effect. So one answer is that our solar system only has tiny planets orbiting close to its star. And actually, there's one tiny planet that does have a high eccentricity, and that's Mercury. But it's actually quite a bit beyond that one quarter zone. It's actually out by about 38%. And by the way, people have done simulations showing that the Mercury will get kicked out of the solar system within the next 10 billion years. So that is going to happen.
Something else to worry about.
Something else to worry about, right. But, you know, it's such a tiny planet. Because after all, we need to appreciate that Mercury is actually smaller than Ganymede, one of the moons of Jupiter. It's not more, it is more massive, but it's actually smaller in terms of its diameter than Ganymede. So it is a tiny planet. And so having it kicked out of the solar system really will have no impact on the Earth. But if you were to kick out something like Venus, or kick out something like Uranus or Neptune, that's a different matter. And that's what we notice with our solar system. 7 of the planets, all the big ones, have circular orbits. But the real question is, how come our solar system is so different from all these other planetary systems? Well, one answer is that instead of our gas giants drifting inward, as appears to be the norm for these exoplanetary systems, our planets drifted outward. And there's a reason why that happened, because we had a much smaller belt of asteroids and comets with a different nature than what we're seeing around these other stars. And what's happening is that we're actually seeing rather than an interaction that causes these gas giants to drift inward, they drift outward. And as they drift outward, their orbits actually become more and more circular. The other reason why it works is Jupiter, the most massive of the planets, actually has a mass that's more massive than all the other planets combined. We now found out that's critical for having such an orderly planetary system. If Jupiter isn't the predominant planet, it doesn't work. It also doesn't work unless Jupiter is the closest of the gas giant planets to the Sun. You want Jupiter to be the closest, Saturn, the next massive planet, to be the next closest, and you want the other two to be farther away. And it's also crucial that they have exactly the distances that they did. In fact, one group of astronomers years ago, and you can dig back about 6 years into today's New Reason to Believe, I wrote up an article on this, making the point that if you look at all the distances of the four gas giants in our solar system, of all the possible distances beyond the orbit, between the orbit of Jupiter and Pluto. So you look at Jupiter and Pluto and say, what are the possible orbital distances? Only 1% of those distances gives you a stable planetary system where advanced life can exist. So 99% of the phase space is dangerous for advanced life. So we're the 1%. Isn't there some kind of controversy going on about the 1% and the 99%? Well, in this case, we are the 1% that escaped that. And also, our gas giant planets, because they have circular orbits and because they're not terribly massive and far away from these stars, do not pump the eccentricity of the Earth, Mars, and Venus. We are immune for that. But one of the things that makes all that work is the moon. If you don't have Earth orbited by a single gigantic moon, then you have a problem with the mean motion resonances generated by Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune. You say, what on earth is a mean motion resonance? That's where one planet, for example, makes exactly two orbits for every nine orbits of another gas giant planet. That's what's called a 2-9 mean motion resonance. You get a 3-5 mean motion resonance. The most dangerous one of all is a 1-2 mean motion resonance. And that actually is another contributing factor for the stability of our planetary system, is that we suffered a 1-2 mean motion resonance between Jupiter and Saturn when the solar system was 700 million years old. And what that did is it scattered away 99% of the comets and asteroids in our planetary system. And by scattering away all those asteroids and the comets, what it did is it began to truncate the drift of the planets. So instead of them drifting too far away or drifting in too close, that did not happen. And by the way, there's another benefit. We get only 1% of the collision events we otherwise would have gotten from asteroids and comets. So it actually makes life, long-term life, safer on planet Earth. It also explains why the Creator waited those 700 million years before creating life here on planet Earth. You want to wait till after you clear out that huge cloud of asteroids and the comets. It still exists today, but it got pushed out beyond the orbit of Neptune. It used to be around the orbit of Saturn. It's now been pushed out beyond the orbit of Neptune. Which means that we have very little risk of damage from those asteroids and the comets. You say, why didn't God get rid of them completely? You need a few. You do need a few to keep things as stable as they are. It's also crucial that the Earth get a few collision events. You don't want big ones, but you do want a few. For example, about 80% of the gold here on planet Earth is attributable to an asteroid that collided in South Africa. And there's an asteroid that collided in Canada that's responsible for over half the nickel deposits, or the nickel that we have mined. Sudbury, Ontario, you might have heard of the Sudbury mine. Well, that Sudbury mine is right on top of an asteroid collision site. And, you know, there are asteroids that are extremely rich in nickel. And so they've been mining that. So we're the beneficiaries of a few lucky hits of the planet Earth that we're able to exploit. For our technology, yes.
Since we're finding loads and scads of these these planets and stuff in other solar systems, is there a way that that we can test to see if there's life other than the chemicals and the atmosphere and stuff like that? Is there any way that we can tell whether there's life in any of these?
Well, a big part of the astrobiological endeavor is trying to find reliable biomarkers. The problem with biomarkers like methane, for example, is you can get methane without biology. The only really reliable biomarker that's out there would be oxygen. So if you have a lot of oxygen in the atmosphere, we really don't know any other way of getting lots of oxygen in a planet's atmosphere other than by having long-lasting, abundant photosynthetic light. But this is not very satisfactory to the astrobiological community because it's basically a test for life that's been around for a few billion years. Because notice with planet Earth, it took 3 billion years to get the oxygen up to 10%. I mean, from 10 to 20 wasn't that big of a deal, but getting it from 1 up to 10, that was a huge problem. Why? Because Earth is filled with lots of minerals that love oxygen. And so when you pump oxygen in the atmosphere, all it does is rust these minerals. And so it just gets pulled out of the atmosphere as fast as you pump it in. And you really can't get up to the 10%+ level until you fill up all what are called the oxygen sinks. And it takes a long time to fill those oxygen sinks. And in terms of trying to measure oxygen in a planet's atmosphere, you know, it's got to be considerably above 1% before you've got any hope of being able to detect that in an unambiguous way. In fact, that's been a lot of concern, is that, you know, if they're trying to measure, say, a 1% oxygen level, well, there are abiogenic ways of getting that much oxygen in the atmosphere. In fact, people have now concluded that Earth had oxygen before it had life in its atmosphere. Why? Because Earth is so loaded with uranium and thorium that the radioactive decay of that uranium and thorium provides an energy source that breaks up water into hydrogen and oxygen. And so even before life existed on planet Earth, there was a steady state flow of oxygen into the atmosphere. Now, we're not talking a lot. We're talking like a tenth of a percent oxygen in the atmosphere. But that can happen without any biology at all. And for what it's worth, that's also a reason why Origin of Life researchers are convinced that life could not have originated here on planet Earth by naturalistic means. A tenth of a percent oxygen in the atmosphere will halt prebiotic chemistry. And we know that that was going on in the early Earth's environment. So that explains why there's all this focus on astrobiology. We've proven it can't happen here on planet Earth by naturalistic means. And if you're an atheist, then it's got to happen somewhere else and get transported to the Earth. The problem is, anywhere else in the solar system, you've got the same situation where if you've got radioactivity and you've got water, you're going to get oxygen. So, and if you don't have water, then you're not going to get life.
Do you have any good way to test whether there's
life there? The only good way is oxygen. But what you're really testing is abundant, long-lasting life. And, you know, what astrobiologists want to do is see if they can find a planet that would have bacteria living for, say, 3 months or less. And we don't have a reliable biosignature for that. So,
so we can actually detect life. Of course, if it was bacteria, you couldn't.
Well, you could if it's bacteria that's been there for 3 billion years. Then you could detect it. Because you know, you're going to have enough photosynthetic activity to build up that level of oxygen. But let me tell you a cheap way to do it. You know, forget about trying to build these sophisticated detectors, excuse me, to detect oxygen in an atmosphere. I mean, that's, right now we don't have the equipment to do that. It's feasible, but it will be expensive to, you know, build that kind of detection equipment. But here's a cheap way. We know that a planet that can sustain photosynthetic life for 3 billion years requires a certain kind of star. And if you don't find that star, then why bother looking? And the news is, we have yet to find such a star in our Milky Way galaxy other than the Sun. So the Sun is remaining alone. And, you know, that's something I'm trying to share with my friends who are involved in the search for extraterrestrial intelligent life. You guys should shut down your program until you've got a solar twin. And without a solar twin, then you're simply wasting time and money.
When you're looking at the Milky Way, it's on a plane like we are, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you're looking, if you look at the Milky Way, how can you see star, or, you know, stars and planets that are in your plane and maybe on the other side of the black hole in the middle? How can you see those? We can't see those yet, can we?
Well, we've actually detected planets in the Andromeda Galaxy 2.1 million light years away. So you can see stuff far away. But you have to use a technique called microgravitational lensing. And what that is where you have your telescope lined up on one or two stars where you've got a star behind it that's got planets. Because Einstein's theory of relativity tells us that a massive body will act as a gravitational lens, and so it'll magnify the light. In fact, this technique would actually allow you to see the light of the planets themselves, not just the star that lies behind.
And on the other side of the black hole, how can they see that? What is? How many light years across
is the galaxy?
Is the Milky Way?
Well, it depends how you measure it. If you're talking about the Milky Way as measured by the distribution of stars, it's about 120,000 light years in diameter. But our galaxy is actually bigger than that if you count the exotic dark matter, which is actually the dominant component of our galaxy. In fact, our galaxy is relatively star poor for its mass. I mean, our galaxy comes in at just under 1 trillion times the mass of our star, the Sun. But the stars only contribute about 200 billion times the mass of our star, the Sun. So most of our galaxy is stuff that's dark. And then beyond that, there's more dark stuff that stabilizes the spiral structure of our galaxy.
What would be the diameter?
The diameter? Well, that again is a difficult question because there are two kinds of dark matter surrounding our galaxy. There's the ordinary dark matter, and there's the exotic dark matter. And the exotic dark matter halo is about 10 times bigger than the ordinary dark matter halo, which is substantially bigger than the galaxy of stars and gaseous nebulae. So, yeah, galaxies are a lot bigger than what we thought they were. And they are now thinking that our galaxy is just as big as the Andromeda galaxy. I remember when I was taking astronomy, we were taught that the Andromeda galaxy was far bigger than our galaxy. It is, if all you look at is the stars. If you look at the total mass of our galaxy compared to the total mass of the Andromeda galaxy, they're roughly equal, and there's a good chance ours might be slightly bigger. So we'll see. That might affect our calculations on when the two of them will merge.
Yeah, so they're going to crash into each other sometime.
They will, but...
chaos.
That's at least 4 billion years out, and it could be as much as 10 billion years out. So I think God's going to conquer the problem of evil a lot more rapidly than that. Anyway, we're finally beginning to understand why it is that our planetary system is the only one we see that has the characteristics that allow advanced life to exist. Everywhere else we look, we see chaos, and we see order in our galaxy. And I think that's been one of the big contributions of looking for these extrasolar planets has helped us understand our own planetary system in a way we never could before. So we now know that there's design features in our solar system that were completely hidden from astronomers until we began to do all this research on these extrasolar planets. And by the way, more is to come. I'm going to cut it off there. I was going to talk to you about another research study on why we see chaos in all these other planetary systems, but I'll save that for another time because I do want to spend at least some time in our lesson, right? Okay. Let me just cut to the chase here. We've been looking at lots of reasons why human civilization can't last for longer than 40,000 years in the context of the same laws of physics that require that it take a minimum of 14 billion years, given the laws of physics that the Creator chose, to enable human life to exist. This is what's called the anthropic principle inequality. When you look at physics, gravity, electromagnetism, thermodynamics, strong and weak nuclear force, it's really impossible to bring human beings upon the cosmic scene in anything less than about 14 billion years. And I've been carefully explaining to you why that's the case. You know, one of the big reasons is that you need to be living on a planet that's got oceans and continents on its surface. You need to be living on a planet that has a strong, stable magnetic field. Without that strong, stable magnetic field, your atmosphere gets sputtered away by solar radiation. And moreover, without that strong magnetic field, you're going to be killed by cosmic rays within a few months. know, God wants the advanced life to live for 60, 70, 80 years, not just 2 or 3 months. It's hard to achieve much civilization if all you're doing is living for a few months. So we need that strong magnetic field, and also we need oceans and continents are critical to recycle the nutrients that we need for advanced life. And by the way, as I've shown you, what you need is oceans and continents, where the continents cover 29% of the surface of the Earth. You know, it was just a couple of months ago that I debated Peter Ward from the University of Washington on the scientific evidence for God. And one of the things he argued is, we know humans can't live here much longer because it won't be long before the continents cover 30% of the surface of the Earth instead of just 29%. We don't do well with 28%. We don't do well with 30%. We need 29%. And as time goes on, as Peter Ward points out, the continents cover more and more of the surface of the Earth. That's because of the plate tectonics. You say, well, couldn't God tone down the plate tectonics? Well, if you tone down the plate tectonics, you can't recycle the nutrients fast enough to keep advanced life going, and moreover, it begins to affect your ability to have that strong, stable magnetic field. So you got to have this aggressive plate tectonics, but as I pointed out in the past, you can't get that aggressive plate tectonics in anything less than many billions of years. Because what drives the plate tectonics is uranium and thorium. And uranium and thorium come from only one source, the eruptions of supernovae. And it takes many generations of supernova eruptions to build up adequate quantities of uranium and thorium. And there's more to the story than that, but the bottom line is this. Our planet has 16,000 times as much uranium as any other Earth-type planet we expect to find in the universe, and 23,000 times as much thorium. And because we are living on the thorium-uranium champions of the universe, then we have these ideal conditions for advanced life. Yes?
Okay. How much longer do we have until it hits 30%?
It'll take a while before it hits 30%. Mm-hmm. It's going to take many millions of years. Yeah. And we're probably talking 10, 20 million years before it hits 30%. And that's also the time frame in which we would expect the sun to get sufficiently bright that it's going to be difficult to sustain photosynthesis. Bottom line is this. If that's all you're looking at is the brightening of the sun and the increase in the continental landmass coverage of the Earth, our planet will become completely sterile within 30 million years. But the first species that will go extinct are the ones with the largest bodies, warm-blooded, with the biggest brains. So we go first. So, and the ones with stripes, there you go. So watch what you wear to class next Sunday, all right? Yes.
How about melting the ice caps? Doesn't that attenuate the motion of the...
Well, what we've been talking about in this class is, yeah, there's some things that will terminate human beings within a million years. There's other things that will terminate human civilization within just a few thousand years. But what's interesting is, and I think a real evidence for supernatural design, there's all kinds of things we human beings need to sustain civilization that have narrow time windows. And, you know, we've been talking about fossil fuels, for example. There are processes that produce the fossil fuels. There's also processes that reduce the fossil fuels without us human beings even mining any of it. And as I've explained, we're living at the ideal coal moment in the history of planet Earth. We're living at the ideal oil moment, the ideal natural gas moment, and even the ideal clath rate moment. So we've been talking about, in terms of fossil fuels, the clath rates have at least 1,400 times more resources than all other fossil fuel deposits combined. And none of this has been tapped yet. So, and we're also living at the ideal time for mineral exploitation. We're living at the ideal time in terms of the sun. You know, as we spent some time here, stars, I'm going to tell this joke again, I know you've heard it before. Stars are like human beings. They're unstable when they're young, they're unstable when they're old, they're maximally stable when they're middle age. But the thing about stars is you get the best stability when it's perfectly middle aged, when it's exactly halfway through its burning cycle. And so for life to be possible, you need to be orbiting a star that's got about 9 billion years worth of fuel. And that star needs to form when the universe has the maximum abundance of uranium and thorium. You add those two numbers up, it comes to about 13.7 billion years. This is why you got to wait that period of time. Okay, a couple of hands here, then I want to draw a conclusion. Yeah.
Steve, would you review with us why 29% on the mechanics of what's happening is important?
Okay, why the 29% is important, and again, you can read the book by Peter Ward. He actually wrote an entire book, The Coming Continental Catastrophe. Interesting story. You know, as time goes on, the continents get bigger and bigger, but eventually it's going to spell doom for the human species. And what Peter Ward points out is that the ratio 29% to, you know, 71%, there's more to it than that. You also have to take into account the elevation of the mountains, the amount of precipitation that's falling on these continents. But the whole idea is the nutrient flow from the continents to the oceans and the oceans back to the continents. That all has to be carefully fine-tuned. Otherwise, you get the wrong life form showing up. And his whole point is it's quite easy to destabilize the ocean if the continents are not just so. And you can destabilize it without wiping life off the planet, but it will be catastrophic to advanced life.
Can you give one concrete example of the flow of nutrients, let's say, from the ocean to the land?
Ocean to the land, while the plate tectonics is going to make new continent, you know, you're going to get, you know, volcanoes erupting, you're going to get, you know, California is getting bigger thanks to plate tectonic activity. The eastern seaboard is getting smaller. That might affect the politics of the state as we move on into the future. So, because some states are growing, but other states are shrinking. But what Peter Ward points out is if you very slightly destabilize the nutrient flow going on the planet, then that's going to favor certain life forms over other life forms. And he's particularly concerned that if the nutrient flow is disturbed even slightly, you're going to wind up with a whole lot of bacteria on the ocean floors, what he calls benthic life, that begin to pump poisonous gases in the atmosphere. Not poisonous for all life, but poisonous for us. And therefore, he says, it's a good thing that we got the continents oriented north-south. It's a good thing we got the oceans spread apart the way they are. And I think we talked about this before. It's another time window in which we're living. Given how rapidly the continents are moving away from one another, given how rapidly they're being they're growing as a result of plate tectonic activity and shifting in terms of their directions, we are living in a time when the oxygen level in the oceans is maximal. So we have very well oxygenated oceans. And one of the things that does is it provides for a maximum biomass in the oceans and provides for the kind of creatures in the ocean that we human beings need. And, you know, so if you start killing off the whales, you start killing off the porpoises, the fish, and replacing that with these nasty bacteria that are producing these toxic blooms and pumping hydrogen sulfide gas in the atmosphere, well, that's not good news for human beings. And so that's one of the reasons why you've got to be very careful about that percentage, but not just the percentage. You've got to be careful about the way the continents are oriented, because of the way it's oriented, it forces ocean currents to go north-south. That's a remarkable thing of planet Earth, our main ocean currents. We have one off the California coast, the Japanese Current. It flows north-south. One of the things that does is it makes for a mild climate all the way up and down North and South America, something you would not get if it wasn't for that north-south flow. So, for example, it makes Southern California artificially cool, and it makes British Columbia and Alaska artificially warm. But what that means is you can have people living in big cities from Alaska all the way down to Mexico without any trouble. If you didn't have that current, that wouldn't happen. And the same thing happens, of course, in the Atlantic, is that you've got people building cities in Norway, which is something it would not happen without the Gulf Stream flowing as effectively as it does. And also happens off of the Asian coast, off of Japan, Australia. You get currents flowing there as well. So, but the bottom line is this. We human beings cannot remain on this planet in a civilized state for longer than what I would calculate to be about 9 or 10,000 years. Now, that's not the maximum time window in which we human beings can exist. We're willing to go back to a population level worldwide of a few million, where our most advanced technology is stone tools, then we could survive a few thousand years longer. Now, actually, quite a few thousand years longer. We could probably extend human existence for maybe a million years. But if you're talking civilization like we enjoyed in the Neolithic Revolution, I'm not talking the 21st century, just the kind of civilization where people are living in towns where they specialize in industries and trade with one another. That started 11,000 years ago. And it was Frank Tipler and John Barrow, both non-Christians at the time, who calculated that that could only be sustained for a maximum of 41,000 years. I've shared with you some reasons why I believe that the time window is actually briefer than 20,000 years. But either way, we're talking, what, 9,000 years, 30,000 years, somewhere in that time range, we need to either return to a Stone Age culture or we go extinct. And based on my conversations with my sons, they're not willing to go back to a Stone Age technology. So that would be a very hard sell to the human population, to give up their iPods, computers, automobiles, TV sets, and also lower the population sufficiently that we could last a little bit longer. But it was Brandon Carter, who was the first to notice this inequality as far back as 1983, who drew the appropriate conclusion. And, you know, he came up with an analogy, but thanks to my wife, I think I've got a better analogy for what this means philosophically. And it is the wedding ceremony. And, you know, I've performed a few weddings over the past years of my ministry. And what I've noticed, at least here in the United States, is that if you take the music out and the introductory remarks by the father of the bride, you wind up with about a 20-minute ceremony. Now, I've known some places where the ceremony lasts only 5 minutes, but typically an average wedding ceremony will go as long as 20 minutes because they might want to have communion and more than just the vows being expressed here. But I also went online and discovered, now this data is about 8 or 9 years old. I've been told that it's actually more extreme today. But 8 or 9 years ago, the average American wedding cost $20,000. I've been told that it's probably a good 50% more than that today. And, you know, it's ridiculous, right? But it's nothing compared to what you see in Japan. In Japan, it's far more expensive. In fact, the cheapest wedding you can get by with in Japan is about $12,000, and it can go up to $1 million. So a wedding is a big deal, much bigger deal, say, in other cultures than it is here in America. We actually are kind of on the tepid side in terms of celebrating a wedding. And, hey, it's not just the $20,000 that the father, the bride, and other relatives shell out for the wedding. Think of the poor bride. How much time does a bride prepare preparing for her wedding day? Yeah, months, sometimes a year. I mean, just getting the invitation cards out and getting the flowers arranged and, I mean, getting the dress. I mean, it's a big deal. I remember what it was like for my wife. In fact, I can tell you a little story about my wife. You know, she was 29 and I was 32 when we got married. And her father took us aside when he discovered we were going to get married and says, you know, my mother and I have talked this over, and we decided we want to contribute to the wedding. We're going to give you $500, and whatever is left you can keep. So poor Kathy, a lot of her life savings got socked into that. Quite a bit of mine went into it, too. So, but the whole point is that's a lot of time and a lot of money for something that lasts just 20 minutes. But would we declare the father of the bride to be mentally unstable for investing something of that nature in something that lasts only 20 minutes? Or the bride and her bridesmaids spending that much time? And look, the mother of the bride puts a lot of time into it too. I remember that episode. I mean, that's a lot of time. In fact, people have estimated it's a minimum of 1 man-year goes into preparing for a typical American wedding, never mind what it costs for an Asian wedding. We do not consider this to be insanity because of the value and the purpose of those 20 minutes. We're recognizing that those 20 minutes are setting the stage for an entire lifetime, and not just a lifetime, but for the next generation, the next several generations are being put in place by that 20 minutes. So because of the extremely high value and the high purpose of those 20 minutes, we don't consider this a waste of investment at all. Well, it was Brandon Carter who also concluded that the only philosophical explanation for this enormous inequality, there must be somebody beyond the universe that has a very high value for the human species and a very high purpose. And the fact is that every feature we look at of the universe must be fine-tuned to make human beings possible. Everything about the universe is pointing towards human beings. The whole thing is out there. That's something I shared with that German atheist quantum physicist. I said, hey, take one star away, it messes it all up. The universe must be exactly the size that it is, no bigger, no smaller, or there'd be no possibility for life, let alone human beings. So it's got to be that big, and it's got to be that old. You're not going to have human beings if the universe is any younger or older than what it is. So the fact that the whole thing is out there just to make our existence possible, and the fact that this enormous inequality is expressed in the physics of the universe, tells us, yes, there must be somebody beyond the universe that values human beings to a great deal, has a very high purpose for human beings. And the fact is, that also applies to us as individuals. Again, that was something I got to share with a quantum physicist. I said, you know, this isn't just the human species. It's for every individual human being. You know, God loved us so much that he didn't consider it too expensive to build a universe with 50 billion trillion stars in it, where that adds up to only 1% of all the stuff of the universe, so that this brief moment in the history of the universe, we could have a nice place to live. And the other thing I noticed too is, you know, there are unpleasantries that go along with these laws of physics. We have to work, for example. But God also has set up things in such a way that we don't have to spend a long time here. You know, my son's pointed out that's one of the blessings of a wedding ceremony. You know, as we bring them along to a wedding, they only have to put up with it for 20 minutes. And then they get to go to the reception, which they think is a much better deal than the wedding, right? But the fact is, it's mercifully brief. Well, likewise, our existence in this universe is mercifully brief. Our lifespans are mercifully brief, and the total time humanity has to spend in the universe is mercifully brief. And as I've explained here before in the class, we are here to bring about, through God's hand, the end of all evil and suffering. We are God's main instrument in his creation to eliminate evil and suffering once and for all. Not the angels, human beings. We are the recipients of God's grace. Our class time is up. So time is short. I'm also being subjected to this inequality that we're facing here. So, but next time we'll pick up the challenges that are rising in the that are coming about, and in terms of what does the Bible say about the origin of human beings, and what does the new scientific evidence tell us in favor of what the Bible teaches about the origin of human beings. Father in heaven, we close here by giving you thanks for creating all this so that we can exist at this brief moment in the history of your creation. Thank you for putting us here at the best possible time. Thank you for putting us here in the only place in the vastness of the universe where we can not only exist, but also thrive. And Father in heaven, I pray we'd appreciate our significance before you, that we not only have a high value, but a very high purpose, that you are our main instrument in your hand to bring about the end of all evil and suffering. And Father, I pray that you would help us by your Spirit to bring about the culmination of the age of this universe in a short period of time rather than a long period of time. Thank you for putting within our hands all the resources that we need to take the good news of salvation through Jesus Christ to all the people and groups of the world. Thank you for giving us the technology, the people resources, and the wealth to literally fulfill that great commission in less than 5 years. Lord, I pray you would give us the motivation, Father, that we could usher in as rapidly as possible the new creation that you have promised will replace this universe. So equip us, Lord, by your Spirit. In Jesus' name, amen.